Yeah, sorry about the background noise, folks. I'm happy to report, though, that the human voice will actually end very soon. So hopefully all you hear is some faint reggae in the background.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative's February web seminar. I'm Julie Little with ELI, and our guest today is Aaron Delwish. I'm lead from Trinity University, where he is assistant professor in the Department of Communications. He is currently CEO of Elastic Collision, and more on Elastic Collision shortly. Before we get started, let me provide you with a brief orientation to our web seminar interface. Your browser should now be showing the title slide for today's talk. As we move through the presentation, slides will advance on your screen. If you want to send messages during the session, please use the chat feature, which you can find in the lower left-hand corner of your screen. There you will see the word to, followed by a colon, and then a drop-down list, which should currently be displaying the word all. Type your message in the blank line, then hit enter. Your message will go to the general chat area. Everyone will see your comment. That's how you'll ask a question or make a comment during today's session. We encourage you to send us questions throughout the seminar. We'll be asking Aaron questions as we go along. If you want to send a private message to someone who is logged into the room, just select the recipient from the drop-down list before typing your message. And if you run into any technical problems, you can connect the WIMBA technical support line listed in the number that Jarrett has just posted in the chat room. And now today's guest, Aaron Delwish. As an assistant professor of communications at Trinity University in San Antonio, Aaron teaches courses on new media, film studies, media interpretation, and video game design. But bridging the academy and industry, he is also founder and CEO of Elastic Collision, a company that develops content and provides consulting for organizations wanting to establish a virtual world presence. And if you're looking for 6 words to describe his interest, just hit his blog site. There you'll find activism, comics, cyberculture, history, science fiction, and zines. Virtual worlds like Second Life may represent, for some educators, an exciting new learning environment, evidenced by faculty using this emerging technology for courses spanning the arts, sciences, and social sciences, and activities focused on active learning and problem solving. For others, it is considered a faddish technology. Aaron will share with us today grounds for both the enthusiasm and skepticism, what virtual worlds are, and suggest how these emerging technologies can be powerful educational tools when supported with learning theory. Remember, if you have questions as we go along, please enter them in the chat room. I'll be sharing your questions with Aaron during the 2 breaks we'll have during the session. And you may want to think about the discussion questions we've also posted on the ELI web seminar website. Aaron, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much, Julie, and thank you to ELI for inviting me to deliver this web-based presentation. I have to admit, it's quite an honor to be doing this. It's also somewhat disorienting to be talking to so many people, and I have absolutely no idea where you are or what you're doing, but I am kind of keeping an eye on the chat, even though I know that Julie will be moderating it. I was wondering if you could just go ahead and type into the chat window where you are right now, your office, at home, on campus, just so I get some sense of feedback of where people are. Wow, okay. All right, so I think it's fair to say that you guys are located on college campuses throughout the country. actually throughout North America and beyond. So that's kind of cool. It's nice to see all of this stuff rolling up. My name is Aaron Dillich, and as was mentioned in my bio, I am an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Trinity University, and I focus on virtual worlds. I teach classes on game design in virtual worlds, and have been doing so since 2002. I started out using the virtual world EverQuest, and from there moved into Second Life. From there I moved into World of Warcraft, and then back into Second Life. I'm also the co-founder of a company called Elastic Collision. I'm on leave right now pursuing the startup venture with my colleague Jennifer Henderson. Elastic Collision is a company that helps organizations establish a presence in virtual worlds, and in particular, we look at ways that virtual worlds can be used for education, as well as ways that they can be used for distributed collaboration. And so with that background, you might wonder if I'm just an intrinsically a booster of the technology, someone who will uncritically tell you that Second Life is the cure to all of your teaching problems. And I'm happy to report that's not the case. I'm very excited about Second Life and other virtual worlds as educational tools, but I think that they're not perfect. What I'd like to do today is talk about my experience with virtual worlds, give you a sense of what the technology is, what its defining characteristics are, and then talk about some of the educational theories that are used to contextualize activities in the virtual classroom, and then close with some concrete tips for educators who are planning to teach in Second Life or another virtual world soon. And as we get started, I was wondering if I could again ask you to use the chat channel. How many people in here have taught a class in Second Life before? If you have, could you just type something about the class into the chat channel, maybe a description of the class that you taught. Emory University, there was a library instruction session taught in Second Life. Some people at the University of Arizona in educational technology and astronomy, okay. All right, that's helpful to me. So I know in adapting my comments kind of that there's some experience with Second Life in the classroom. Social psychology, digital printmaking, that's great. I'm going to guess that most of the people in this group, in this virtual room, have not taught a complete class in Second Life before, and so I'm going to adapt my remarks that way. While we're active in the chat channel right now, if you could go ahead and type in the names of any virtual world other than Second Life with which you're familiar. So if I were to say to you, I work with virtual worlds, I teach with virtual worlds, okay, Bear.com, World of Warcraft, Protosphere, Croquet, Active Worlds, Ragnarok Online, I think that, is that, Megan, is that right? Okay, Active Worlds. A lot of people do work with Active Worlds, City of Heroes, Google Earth. Okay. So there's a lot of familiarity out there with the different virtual world platforms, and that's great. Power Up, that's interesting. Is that a game world? I guess it is. Okay, so I started teaching with virtual worlds first at the University of Washington, but really I was allowed to focus on it when I moved to Trinity University in 2003. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Trinity, it's a small liberal arts college, a secular liberal arts college in San Antonio with about 2,400 students. We have a terrific library system, a really robust technical infrastructure, and I think that's really important to know when you hear me talking about my experiences, that none of this would have been possible without a really great supportive technological environment. And that's one of the hurdles that you have to overcome as an educator, is making sure that you have access to machines that are capable of running Second Life. So moving now to the next slide, I'm going to show you some of my students. And I understand that there's some background noise. I'm kind of trying to cover the phone with my hand. Is that making it any less gurgly or choppy? Is it any better? Okay, good. All right, and Valerie says turn up your volume under the video block. That can help as well. Okay, cool. So these are students at Trinity University from last spring's Virtual World Promotions class. You can see we have a lab with 15 students. And one thing that I love about this picture is the way that their attention is riveted on the screens. They are all present in a space together, but they're not actually very present physically in the classroom. In fact, their minds are projected into the world of Second Life. And students often comment on this after the class is over, that they're amazed about how quiet it is during the Second Life component of the class, because there's so much interaction and dialogue happening online, and not as much when we're in Second Life, that is, actually happening in the classroom. And Susan says, my voice is being drowned out by the music. I'm trying to help. I think if you turn up your volume under the video block, it might help, Susan. The students in this lab were part of the Virtual World Promotions class, and what they were charged with doing in this class was using the platform of Second Life to study theories of online marketing, online persuasion, and to tie together, to synthesize a batch of skills that would be very common in the new media workplace. And so students, as part of this class, read everything they could possibly get their hands on related to Second Life and virtual worlds in general, as well as a wide body of marketing theories of how to reach the new consumer, the millennial consumer. And then they split up into groups and actually planned themselves a social networking service, a dating service in Second Life, and they marketed it in Second Life and then presented it to scholars and to other marketing people from around the world using the platform itself. I'm sorry, Suzanne, I don't know what to do to help improve the sound. Jarrett may have some suggestions, and I will try to enunciate.
No, at this point, I think we just have to soldier on.
Okay, I'm just going to soldier on. Oh, this is just a pointer to the Elastic Collision site. If you want to find out more about the work the company does, you can point your browser to that URL after the talk. We'll also be posting a white paper next week on the use of virtual worlds in higher education that you might find interesting. So to find out more about Elastic Collision, this is where you should head. Okay, so I asked a moment ago if people could describe or name virtual worlds. And a number of names were thrown out there, and you can scroll back in the chat window to see some of those names, Bear.com, Second Life, worlds such as World of Warcraft, EverQuest, Ragnarok Online. These days, virtual worlds are really trendy. People are calling almost anything that has any sort of online interaction as a component of virtual world. And sometimes the word is thrown around in ways that is not very precise. And so I think in really kind of cutting through the hype and talking about how we can use virtual worlds to teach, it's helpful to have a more specific definition. I'm going to argue that there are four defining characteristics of virtual worlds. These are characteristics that you'll find in all virtual worlds, whether they're game worlds like the World of Warcraft or EverQuest 2, or social virtual worlds such as Second Life. And the first of these characteristics is that they are online simulated environments. They're game-like environments. And for people in the audience for this webinar who grew up in the era of Pong, it's really amazing to see the improvements in graphics that have taken place. I mean, if you think about it, the movie Toy Story came out in the early to mid-1990s, and we were just amazed at seeing that level of computer graphical detail in the movie theaters. But that level of computer graphical detail has now become commonplace in almost all video games, whether they're PC-based games or console-based games on platforms such as the Xbox or the PS3 or the Nintendo Wii. And these simulated environments, these game-like worlds, they give users and players the sense of actually being in a different space. There's a sense that you're present somewhere else, and it can be really very compelling, sometimes too compelling. If you know anybody who has been swallowed up by a virtual world, it is sometimes almost too compelling. Sorry for pausing there. I just got a strange message from my system. So I think that I got dropped out of my slides. Oh, no, here we go. Okay. This is a screenshot from a virtual world called Vanguard. This was intended as a game world that was supposed to be the big successor to World of Warcraft, which is hands down the most popular, massively multiplayer virtual world in the West. I chose this slide just because it gives you a sense of the graphical detail. This is not just something that unfolds on the screen. This is a world that players are immersed in. So if you look at the bodies there, the people standing there talking, those could quite easily be controlled by different human beings in different locations. And for that matter, you know, in some of these games, even the chickens could be actual players. So this is the first characteristic of these virtual worlds. They're synthetic, immersive environments that are very compelling, sometimes too compelling, and they give users the sense that they're present in another location. And so I'm moving now to the next slide, I hope. Just one second, I am adjusting something with the technology, but I'm going to keep talking. Let's see, that was slide 10. Jared, thank you so much for helping me label these slides, because I think that it just became really helpful. Here we go. This is a screenshot from the game Oblivion. This is actually not technically a multiplayer game, but I also included it just to give you a sense of the graphical realism, how compelling these virtual worlds can be. It's really light years away from Pong. So that's the first characteristic of virtual worlds. They're synthetic environments created by computers that give users the sense of being present someplace else. Now, the second characteristic that's really important in virtual worlds is that users or players are represented as avatars. And an avatar is a representation of your game character. In many cases, these representations of people's game characters are much like themselves. They look very similar to what they look like in real life. In other cases, these are fantasies, you know, sort of a fantastic persona that they're projecting into the immersive world. And that actually can have some really powerful educational benefits in the context of role-playing and empathy exercises. I'll talk about that a little bit later, but I'm wondering, in the back chat area, does anybody know where the word avatar comes from? Not the game context of avatar, but does anybody have any other kind of sense of the definition of avatar? Yeah. Hinduism, it's a Hindu religious incarnation. As I understand it, the word avatar in the Hindu religion refers to the incarnations that gods would take when they would walk upon the earth among the mortals. And it has to do with the incarnation of a godlike being in a very specific instantiation of the world. Somebody says, isn't lifting swords and stabbing basically Pong? That's a really good point. These avatars that people create, you might think, well, isn't this basically Pong? Isn't this just their paddle that they take into the world of Dungeons & Dragons Online or World of Warcraft? And the answer is yes and no. I mean, these avatars become much more than a paddle to people who are immersed in these worlds. And the key thing to understand here is that for most virtual world residents, whether they're in game worlds or social virtual worlds, it's not like they just keep recreating new avatars every time they sit down. These avatars have a lifespan. They live in the virtual world for years, sometimes many years. And people invest their avatars with a huge amount of personal energy, and they gain skills. They become more skilled in the domain of the virtual world. If it's a world such as Second Life, perhaps that means that they're building up social relationships and social networks. If it's a game world, maybe it means that they've become really good at combat. I wanted to show you these photographs from an exhibit called Alter Ego. If you like the work, you might want to jot down the name Robbie Cooper. He's the artist who went around the world and talked to people about their real-life selves and their game selves. One of my favorite slides, and I think you'll find this popping up in all sorts of discussions of avatar identity, is the one at the bottom. Now, you can see there's a kid who's in a wheelchair, and he has an adaptive device for breathing, and you can see his game character in the game Star Wars Galaxies. he's sort of a bounty hunter, for those of you who are Star Wars geeks, I think, like a Boba Fett type bounty hunter. And there's some really amazing things implicit in this slide and his avatar representation. For one thing, in the game world, he is not visibly limited by any sort of disability, which is really terrific and can be very liberating for people. Yeah, sure, Susan. The name of the artist is Robbie Cooper, and the exhibit is the Alter Ego exhibit. So he's free in this virtual world, at least free of the preconception. Sorry, Eve, it's Cooper, C-O-O-P-E-R. And he's free in the virtual world, free of the kind of bias that people sometimes bring to people with disabilities. But at the same time, you can see a connection between his virtual world incarnation and his real-life identity, in that his virtual world character also requires some special apparatus to breathe. And a kind of sad postscript to this is the fact that Star Wars Galaxies, the game, was completely revamped by Sony Online Entertainment about 2 years ago in an attempt to kind of build up the player base. And when they revamped the game, they wiped out all of the controls that people with disabilities were using to access that world. And I just am sort of mentioning that as an aside, because it's an important thing to remember as teachers, that the usability of these worlds is important, and also accessibility of these worlds. So that's the second characteristic, the avatarization of identity in virtual worlds. So not only are these synthetic, immersive spaces there, very much like what Neal Stephenson talked about in the novel Snow Crash, but also people are investing themselves in an avatar identity. Kathleen asks, isn't Second Life also inspired by Neal Stephenson's novel Snow Crash? And the answer is yes, definitely. In fact, the word that's often used to describe Second Life and other virtual worlds is metaverse. And the term metaverse refers to the grandparent of all virtual worlds. It's sort of a vision that people are striving towards. And we haven't really materialized the metaverse yet, but it's a vision that is rooted in the work of Neal Stephenson. Now, a third defining characteristic of virtual worlds is that multiple users are co-present at the same time. So it's not just you in this world in your ideal avatar body. Actually, there are many, many people logged on simultaneously. I think right now in Second Life, the average concurrency rates are about 60,000 people logged on into the virtual world at the same time. And you'll find even higher concurrency figures with some of the more popular game worlds. What you see in this slide right here is players of World of Warcraft who've engaged in this bizarre, like, synchronized dance to create a smiley face from above. You'd have to wonder why somebody would actually want to do this, but it also shows kind of the intense collaboration that takes place in these spaces, even in a game space that's as limited in many ways as World of Warcraft. Chris says the maximum concurrency he's seen recently in Second Life is about 35,000 minimum, 60,000 maximum. Thanks, Chris. That's really helpful. And, you know, it's sort of a double-edged sword because as Second Life continues to grow, concurrency goes up, and then they have technical problems and the grid crashes. But it's just amazing to see that there are now 60,000 people logged on simultaneously. When people first started using Second Life in the classroom not so long ago, you know, there were a maximum of 4,000 players at all even registered in Second Life. This slide just shows you a guild that's gathering in World of Warcraft for an event. This massive simultaneous concurrency in these virtual spaces enables all sorts of social formations, from weddings to funerals to all sorts of outbursts of social activism. There have been anti-war protests, for example, in Second Life, and there have been anti-war protests even in the game world, like World of Warcraft. The fourth characteristic of these virtual worlds is persistence. And what I mean by this is that the worlds register changes that people make. So some worlds are more persistent than others, but imagine that there's a tree in the world that is cut down by one of the players. Persistence means the player, the tree no longer exists after it has been cut down. People can make changes to the environment that are stable. You see this in Second Life. The entire world, all of the content, is built out by the users. And it's just really amazing to see. And what you see right here in this slide is a user's apartment in a game world. I think this is EverQuest 2. I'm not positive. But what happens is users in the game world will wander around and collect things, and if they get more treasure, they actually start buying things to decorate their apartment. And it's a persistent place they can have people over to visit. Also, as an aside, part of the reason these apartments exist is because they have a problem with inflation in the game world. It's a way of getting the higher level players to spend some of their money. So to recap, those are the four defining characteristics of virtual worlds. They're immersive synthetic spaces in which users are represented as avatars. There are many users co-present simultaneously. As Chris mentioned, sometimes up to 60,000 on a given day. And Michael added that it was 65,000 was the most recent record. That's a lot of people online at the same time, and they're persistently changing the world. Cindy asked if the presentation will be posted somewhere for review later, and the answer is yes, it will, both on the EDUCAUSE site and also on the Elastic Collision site. A footnote to all of this is the difference between social virtual worlds and game worlds. I've been throwing that distinction around. The game worlds are worlds like World of Warcraft and EverQuest. They're traditionally themed like a role-playing game, such as Dungeons & Dragons. They can be viewed as somewhat frivolous by some, but they're really still very interesting and complex social spaces. This is a screenshot from EverQuest 2, a leading game world. And then you have the social virtual world, such as Second Life. Slide 20, which is about to appear on your screen, shows you what a social virtual world looks like. The difference is that social virtual worlds are designed completely by the users. There's not a set of rules in the same sense that you would have in a traditional game. And so this is a gathering, an educational gathering that happened in Second Life in a building that was created by users. Everything you see in this slide, the chairs that people are sitting on, the screen on which things are being projected, the clothes that people are wearing, the little speaker in the background, all of that is created by the users. And that's a social virtual world that tends to focus more on interaction and creation than the game world, although the game world also do have a lot of interaction and creation. As an educator, I think right now, social virtual worlds have more potential in the classroom just because they offer more of a blank slate, but that doesn't mean that social virtual worlds are the only way to go. In fact, I've had some great success in research methods classes with the game world. The last thing I wanted to talk about before pausing for questions, I realized that I've already taken up quite a bit of time. Is something you've probably noticed that virtual worlds are being used for all sorts of serious uses right now, not just for education, but also for money. Making the entrepreneurial activities are amazing. This is Anshe Chung. She was one of the first so-called virtual world millionaires who earned $1 million through virtual real estate. Yes, I'll pause now. Hi, Julie, did you have something to say?
No. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry.
No problem.
This is a tabloid that covers the scene in Second Life. You can see the brands that have entered Second Life in the past year. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that there's sort of a cycle that goes between hype and backlash. And, you know, for a month, all of the advertising and marketing publications are announcing that everybody will someday live in a virtual world, and then there's a huge backlash. But Second Life continues to grow steadily for both the educational uses and the commercial uses. This is an example of a book signing. The author Julian DeBell is signing his book, Play Money, in a Virtual World. He actually did a virtual book signing where people could buy the virtual book and also buy the real-world book at the same time. This is a screenshot of the Nissan build. Car companies have been very interested in Second Life. And one thing that the marketing companies are finding out is that actually Second Life tends to skew a bit older. And this is just an example of a conference, such as the one we're having right now, that is taking place in the virtual world of Second Life. So I think I'll pause here and turn the mic over to Julie for questions.
Well, there's a question that's been posted by Cindy, Aaron, and it says, I'm assuming that even though a virtual world contains multiple users, is there a way for educators to limit access to their specific class of students?
That's a great question, and it depends upon the virtual world. Certainly in Second Life, it is possible if you own your own island or have control over your own segment of an island to control access to the virtual space where you're teaching.
And Alan said that he missed the last part where you mentioned skew a bit older. Could you review that a little bit, Aaron?
Yeah, certainly. Recently, Jennifer Henderson and I conducted a survey of more than 800 residents for the company Orange, which is France Telecom's cell phone brand, as well as for Metaverse Utility. And in that research, we found out a lot about the demographics of users, and we confirmed a consistent finding, which is that most Second Life users tend to be over the age of 25, and a significant number are over the age of 35. So the image that some people have of Second Life being a playground for college-age, additional college-age students, it's not really accurate. It's years older. And that's something that it's really interesting, too, when you try to bring Second Life into the classroom. You know, hardcore gamer students are sometimes really kind of skeptical because it's not as slick as some of the games they're playing.
And Tom asked, are there publishers developing these to beef up their electronic media?
I'm not sure by publishers, what sorts of publishers Tom means.
Tom, if you'll define that for us, are you talking about textbook publishers, educational publishers, or faculty as publishers? Textbook publishers was the first question.
I think that there is definitely strong interest right now. We haven't seen, as far as I know, a huge migration of textbook publishers into Second Life, but publishers are definitely eyeing this as a way of bringing authors into contact with the audiences. But so far, I'm not aware of any like college textbook publishers who have yet done something significant with Second Life, but you know, there's so much happening, you can't keep track of it all. So if anybody else knows about such a project, they should speak up now.
Thanks, Aaron. Why don't we go ahead to the next section of slides?
Okay. Thanks a lot. So I've given you sort of the quick and dirty summary of what virtual worlds are. And as you know, there's been a lot of attention to different ways that they can be used in the classroom. And the question is this just, you know, is it a bunch of hype? You know, is this the next big thing? And I hear this in different ways. There are a lot of faculty that I've met on different campuses who are still kind of frustrated about having Blackboard shoved down their throats and PowerPoint shoved down their throats. And sometimes there's resistance about just sort of the question, like, is this really something that's going to improve the classroom experience? And I think it's a really valid question. And the answer is, in many situations, in fact, in most situations, probably not. But there are some cases in which virtual worlds, such as Second Life, can really strengthen the process of education. And there's some reasons that we have to think that virtual worlds and game-like environments could be helpful. And the pedagogical rationale, I would break down into four points, and I see some great questions flowing up in chat that we'll definitely address as well in the next question and answer session. But in terms of pedagogical rationale, why do we think virtual worlds are other game spaces? Why would I argue that there's ever a chance for them to work? Well, the first thing is that these spaces can be highly engaging. Many of you are familiar with the book Flow by the unpronounceable author. I keep trying to learn how to pronounce his name, and I can never get it right. Csikszentmihalyi. Ah, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
He's a fantastic writer, and the concept of flow is really something that all teachers, I think, are familiar with. It's that, you know, ideal, optimal psychological state that we're sometimes in when we're teaching or when we're writing or students are in when they're learning, kind of when you're hovering in the jaws between something you already know how to do and something you're learning how to do. And you just keep going because you know you can get there. And that's a place we're trying to get our students, and that is a mechanic that is built into all successful video games. If a video game can't induce its flow state, you know, it's not really going to take off because people can't get to level 3 if they can't get past level 2. So one reason to think that there is some potential here is that these spaces are highly engaging if they're deployed in the right way. Another reason that these spaces could also be seen as highly potentially useful as pedagogical tools is the fact that you can engage in avatar role play. Role play is really a powerful tool for getting people to identify with other perspectives and to get them to think outside themselves. And I'm sure that many of you have experienced role play in your own classrooms. You don't have to have a computer to do it. You can just do it by handing out pieces of paper and asking students to assume a different role. But there's something about these virtual worlds, aesthetic spaces, and the play that students engage in with their avatars that has the potential, I think, to liberate their imagination and also to make them a little less shy than they would be face-to-face. I've seen students who are, really shy in real life who just unfold an entirely different side of their personality in the virtual world. We've had some great luck doing diversity role-playing trainings in Second Life, and in fact did a fantastic experiment with a furry. For those of you who don't know, furries are Second Life avatars that are like mammals. They have fur, and they encounter a lot of discrimination in Second Life. So we organized a furry job interview, and it actually turned out to be a pretty good way of getting people to think about diversity issues. So that's the second potential rationale for using Second Life or other virtual worlds in the classroom. A third rationale is that these multi-user spaces, especially the social virtual worlds, can promote collaborative problem solving. And what you see on the screen right now is taken from a fantastic site. It's called Global Kids. It's a MacArthur Foundation-sponsored project that brings kids together from around the world using the medium of Second Life. And they do this on the team grid. And you can see on the left side, students are gathering at a conference that's talking about the problem of trafficking, human trafficking, in the left image. And in the right, you can see a comic book that they created using screenshots from Second Life. These students are distributed in different locations, and they built out this comic book using the tools built into Second Life. And it's just one of many examples of how these virtual worlds can enable problem solving and collaboration in ways that it's really difficult to get students to do with those dreaded group projects. I mean, I don't know about you, but in most of my non-virtual classes, when people talk about group projects, like students start to roll their eyes and get really worried about just having to coordinate. And there's something about these virtual spaces that makes it a little easier to organize. A fourth real easy kind of resource rationale is that you can overcome different limitations of these virtual worlds. This is a screenshot of Professor Richard Bartle, who's based in the UK. He's the founder, and he really is one of the inventors of the virtual world technology. And he was able to meet with Trinity students in real time in the virtual world of NORAS, which is part of the game EverQuest 2. The only problem was that monsters kept wandering up, and so we'd have to jump up and fight them and kill them and then sit back down, which was kind of a hassle, but actually kind of fun as well, and everybody got into it. But imagine if your guest speaker could just start killing gigantic rats with your students. It tends to lighten things up a bit. Of course, it depends on the type of class that you're teaching. And then the final potential rationale that I want to talk about right now, and I think perhaps the most important, is that these virtual spaces, this sort of online interaction, mirrors the 21st century workplace that our students are going to be interacting in. This is an empty conference room in Second Life, but increasingly conference rooms like this are being populated by workers who are meeting together. They live in different parts of the world, and they'll come together in a space like this to meet with clients, to talk about design, to talk about programming logic. All of the things that knowledge workers do, all of the symbolic discussion that they're engaged in can take place through Second Life. And in fact, I'm sorry about the background noise. I'm trying to cover it with my hand. In fact, another this very situation that we're engaged in right now, the very nature of this conversation is a perfect example of the sort of mediated communication technologies. They're still kind of new. We're still folding them into our lives. And I think that our students will live with them in a way that we're kind of just starting to get used to. And so I put up this slide right here of some technology companies. I'm wondering, does anybody else, anybody have any ideas of where this might be? Is it the background noise, Thomas, that's causing problems, or is it? Alan, everything is okay here, yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm doing the best I can with muting it out. I'll just soldier on. Okay, people are guessing this is the Silicon Valley, which is a very logical guess, right? These are all the classic Silicon Valley companies. But actually, this is a good guess, Catherine, very close. This is not the Silicon Valley in California. This is the Silicon Valley of India in Bangalore. And this is taken from a poster called IT Loves Bangalore. The point I'm trying to make is that knowledge work, technology work, really a huge number of jobs in the growing information economy exist in mediated ways. I mean, I think many of us have had the experience of calling for tech support or calling to talk to someone for help with our taxes, and we find that we're talking to someone in the upper part of the world. And there's no use in complaining about this or worrying about it. It's just the nature of contemporary global capitalism. And technologies like Second Life and these virtual worlds and like the web-based system we're using right now, really, they're the technologies that make it possible for a global workplace to unfold. So it's a great reason to use these in the classroom is to give our students kind of a head start in thinking about virtuality and mediated interaction. And hopefully they'll be smart enough to not make the mistake I made of having all of this background music playing when trying to engage in a web-based seminar. Hopefully they'll take away that lesson. One last thing before we pause for questions again is, the theoretical context for all of this, there are different pedagogical theories that people can reference. The one that I found the most useful is the notion of situated learning. And I don't want to go into it in too much detail because I'm sure many of you are already familiar with it, but the key theorists are Levy and Wenger. I don't know how to pronounce their names. That often happens with material that I read, but it's Levy and Wenger, Wenger. Really what they had called for is a reconceptualization of knowledge. It goes beyond the outdated concepts that, the instructor stands in front of the classroom and he or she has the knowledge in their head and they just sort of shove it into the heads of the students. I mean, you are educators. You know as well as I do that this really doesn't work for many types of classroom activities. Of course, there are, some types of classroom activities for which it is actually quite effective. But for a lot of the types of things that we're doing in the 21st century classroom, this approach, the old-fashioned approach, doesn't work. Situated learning argues that knowledge is socially constructed, and instead of teaching students by making them think that they're just repositories for knowledge from an expert, we need to encourage them to think of themselves as members of communities of practice. You know, a newsroom is a great example of a community of practice. A game development workshop would be another. An advertising agency would be another. A school classroom would be another. But their point, long before virtual worlds, was that you can really have powerful effects if you convince students to think of themselves as situated in a community of practice, whatever it is, ethnography, teaching, computer programming, online marketing, and that sort of identification that they engage in parallels in many ways what happens with role-playing, right? So you can have every student in a science class thinking of themselves as a member of a community of practice of scientists. Virtual worlds make it possible to do this in ways that have a sort of immersive spatial representation, and they also have all sorts of tools for social networks that nurture these communities of practice. So I'm going to pause at this point because I think there's a lot of questions backing up and try to address some of these questions. This should give you an idea of some of the reasons that some of us think that virtual worlds have potential.
Yes, Erin, as you can imagine, when you asked how many people were, you know, teaching in a virtual world or participating in one, we didn't have quite as many responses. So a question came in, how difficult is it to learn Second Life? And I'd like to append another question along with that is, can you give an estimate of how long it would take a faculty member to develop a realistic virtual world that's viable for educational purposes?
That's a really great point. And I think, I mean, it's a great question because the answer is that it takes time. I mean, speaking about Second Life in particular, it is not the easiest learning curve for anybody to get involved with. Even, you know, relatively technically savvy gamers have problems at first when they're trying to get involved with Second Life. But it is within the realm of possibility if you're patient. But I would suggest that any teacher who's planning to teach a class in Second Life should plan to spend the previous semester doing a lot of their own kind of groundwork in Second Life, kind of wandering around and learning how to navigate the community as a user. The thing is, the teacher doesn't have to build everything themselves. There are a lot of really great content creators in Second Life, I mean, thousands and thousands, who would be willing to help out with an exciting project, and they could be recruited. And as Catherine points out, you know, it kind of depends on the goals that you're pursuing with your class. Thank you, Pat, for posting the Levin Winger citation.
Another question that came in is in relationship to support. And so part of it was, do you have a staff at Trinity that works on programming for creating Second Life environment? And then along those lines, what kind of support do you provide faculty to integrate Second Life in their classes?
That's another great question. I mean, at Trinity, we're very fortunate to have just an incredibly robust technology and library and information infrastructure with some fantastic people, many of who I'm sure you've met at various conferences, who provide all sorts of support. But in my case, I've actually done all of this stuff in Second Life myself just because I'm kind of a game geek and I was really excited about it. But I know there is the skill set there and there's a lot of enthusiasm for it, but there's not like an institutional commitment right now to staff up Second Life classes at this moment. But it's something that they're keeping an eye on, definitely.
And someone had posted earlier that when they prepped their Masters of Information Sciences students to use Second Life, I told them it would take 4 to 6 hours to get oriented, and they said that was about right last spring. So a question came in, how do you bring your students up to speed when you start a new class in Second Life?
That is always a problem, and the learning curve can be really hard at first. I mean, and you get a few problems. I mean, not only is there just the intrinsic learning curve, but if you have students, which you will, who are insecure about their technical skills, sometimes they end up sitting next to the gaming jock, you know, who thinks she's God's gift to Halo 3 and Counter-Strike, and it can be really intimidating when the really awesome gamer woman is sitting next to the guy who doesn't have much technical expertise. And so the learning curve is always going to be a challenge. One solution I've found is you just have to fold in, I think, if you're really making a commitment to Second Life, fold in additional class time beyond what you would ordinarily expect to do in a class for that number of units. I think it's a good analogy would be a film class. I mean, we're very used to the idea of film studies classes having a mandatory weekly viewing where all the students have to come watch the movie. I do the same thing with Second Life, where all the students have to come to the lab, at least during the first half of the semester, and start learning how to use Second Life. Also, there's a guy, I think his name is Joe Sanchez, who teaches at the University of Texas, Austin. If you Google his name and Second Life, he's been writing a lot about this recently as well, and he's had some interesting experiments with just kind of throwing them out there into the wild and just forcing them to sink or swim and finding that they teach each other. I haven't tried that yet, but it does look like an interesting approach. His name is Joe Sanchez at the University of Texas, Austin, and if you Google his blog, you'll find his discussion of those issues.
And a couple of questions have come in, Aaron, in reference to accessibility. One specifically, does it work with visually impaired students? And then in generally, what are the accessibility issues?
It's Second Life does work in limited ways with visually impaired students and with people with all sorts of disabilities. You know, the key there, I think, with a lot of adaptive technology is the ability to convert to ASCII text. But at its heart, it is a visual medium, and so there are a lot of problems there in terms of accessibility and the content. There's also a lot of really interesting activity around this right now. There are users in Second Life with disabilities who are organizing to talk about these issues. And I also know for a previous project I was working on with some people in the State Department that there's a real push in government agencies to push to make Second Life and other virtual worlds accessible. And hopefully we'll see people doing, something for virtual worlds along the lines of what Microsoft did for accessibility in the Windows platform in the early 90s. I mean, we love to talk trash about Microsoft, but sometimes they get it right. And they really did demonstrate a commitment to accessibility in their operating system, and we need to see that with virtual worlds as well.
Aaron, a question came in regarding research collaborations. Could you speak to any examples of research collaborations in Second Life?
Yeah, certainly. I've seen a number of examples. I think the best thing I could do is point you towards the SLED list. I already saw that URL floating around. The Second Life Educators List is a fantastic source, both for teachers and researchers, and most of us who are both teachers and researchers, I think. And you can find a lot of leads there. Also, I would encourage you to check out the blog Terra Nova. I don't know the exact URL, but if you Google Terra Nova virtual worlds, you'll find a discussion of virtual world research. It talks a lot about collaborative projects. And also, if you send me email at aaron@elasticcollision.com, I'd be happy to point you towards some of my students' past research projects as well. There's just an enormous amount out there. It's really exciting right now.
And a question has come in about, a question asked for the URL again for Elastic Collision.
Oh, sure. It's the word Elastic Collision as all one word, so elasticcollision.com.
And a couple of questions have come in about avatars. One, it says since people invest so much in creating their avatars, is there any movement towards interoperability so that my avatar might be able to exist in more than one virtual world?
That's a really exciting topic right now that people are trying to figure out the answer to. The issue of interoperability is one of the big industry debates right now. Exactly how interoperable will these virtual worlds be? How portable will our avatars be? IBM recently partnered with Linden Lab to pursue these issues. And there's a blog called Virtual Worlds News. It covers a lot of these industry discussions and things like interoperability. If you Google Virtual Worlds News, you should find that blog. And also there's a blog called Worlds in Motion, which covers the same territory. And they're talking a lot about interoperability.
And another question came in that asked, what do you consider to be the appropriate class size for a Second Life class, Aaron?
Well, I think as always, smaller is better. I mean, I have been really fortunate at Trinity to work with some really small classes where we have about 15 or 16 students. I know of other professors who have been very successful with classes twice that size. My gut would suggest that if you get over 30, it's going to be very difficult.
And a question regarding using Second Life for advising. Andreas asked, and it could be that others can respond in the chat room, but have you had an ear to the ground on that, Aaron, using Second Life for advising services?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there's in an informal way. I mean, I'm talking right now with a lot of different advisors who are interested in trying to figure out ways that could be incorporated at a more institutional level. I've found myself sometimes giving informal advising to students in Second Life kind of as an adjunct to other types of classroom interactions, but that can also become kind of strange. And, that was an issue I wanted to talk about is, the problem that the boundaries can become very blurry in these virtual worlds between teacher and advisor and student. And, I guess what I'm trying to say is that there are a lot of issues kind of wrapped up in the advising question in virtual worlds that we're just starting to think about.
And a couple of resource questions that folks asked. One was, when and where will the white paper be available that you spoke about, Aaron, and also repeating the two blog names you listed?
Yeah, sure. And I should mention, Julie, that I just, because another speaker started in the background, I just stepped away from the booth, so I'm not looking at my computer right now.
Okay.
But the white paper will be up on the Elastic Collision site next week, and I mean, it synthesizes a lot of the stuff I've been talking about today. We're trying to give sort of a thumbnail sketch of the strengths and limitations of Second Life and other virtual worlds in higher education. The blogs that I mentioned are the Worlds in Motion blog. That's Worlds in Motion. If you just Google that with the word virtual worlds, you should find it. And also Virtual Worlds News. The reporter who writes that blog is named Joey Seiler, S-E-I-L-E-R. And he's just got some really great industry analysis, and he talks a lot about these things like interoperability.
Thanks, Aaron. We've only got about 5 minutes left in our session. Lots of good questions coming in. So if we could go ahead and roll through the last section of the slides. Please continue your questions, and certainly Aaron will be available through email to answer questions.
Yeah. So would you prefer, Julie, that we answer the questions now or go to the slides?
Why don't we go ahead and finish up the slides, and then we'll have maybe time for one final question. If not, you've made your email address available to folks and they have a direct connection with you.
Okay. That sounds great. Since I walked away from the computer, I can't control the slides. Would it be possible to forward the slides to the teaching tips in Second Life?
Sure. Jarrett will drive the slides. Thanks.
Yeah, Aaron, I just pushed slide 41.
Okay. And I think the first point I had there was that it's really important to make a real commitment to Second Life if you're going to use it in the classroom. And this is something that people had asked in the previous questions, like, is this something you can just kind of fold in as like 1 week of your syllabus, or is it something deeper? And I think for it to be successful, it really has to be much deeper. I mean, you have to get yourself immersed in the community. Sorry, I just walked back to get my slides. So the point I wanted to make is that you can't, I would, in most cases, unless you're just kind of experimenting with the range of virtual world platforms out there as an adjunct to your course content, I would be hesitant to fold Second Life into a class curriculum if you're not really determined to kind of deal with all of the different hurdles that you're going to have to fix. I'm not trying to discourage people, just to point out that it can be a lot of work. Can we go to the next slide? Slide number 42?
Oh, we're actually on 43 now. Sorry.
Okay, great. So yeah, so plan for a steep learning curve. We've already talked about that. And also address the hardware issues up front. You know, this is becoming less of a problem these days, but Second Life is very demanding on system hardware. In particular, it demands high-quality graphics cards. And so I know there's a lot of interest right now in using Second Life for distance education, which is very exciting, but it's really important to make sure that students have computers that are able to run the software. And if not, then are you going to be able to get access to a lab that has the computers that are able to run the software? And I think it really helps to have supportive IT people that you can work with. I mean, we've been really lucky at Trinity. Fortunately now, there's more attention to Second Life. I think that a lot of doors that were once closed as far as getting resources and support for these sorts of Second Life labs, those doors are opening up. Going on to the next slide, I would strongly encourage people to tap into the extensive community resources, both in-world and out-of-world. So somebody was asking, for example, am I going to be able to create a module for my class all by myself? Probably not, but you don't need to do it by yourself. I mean, the whole point of the internet and things like this web seminar is that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can share our knowledge. We're situated in communities of practice. And Second Life is in that class net tradition of people wanting to share their knowledge. So I would strongly encourage educators to check out the SLED list and to really get to know the in-world content creators, because you don't have to do it all yourself. The fifth point, going on to the next slide, is just that with virtual worlds in the classroom, you know, I found that... So the fifth point is just that with virtual worlds in the classroom, you know, the first time I went in, I really didn't want to lay down any rules and be too strict, and I just kind of set students loose, and I found out that could be really counterproductive. It's an old story. I think we all know it. Whether it's a virtual classroom or, you know, a face-to-face classroom, trying to walk the line between freedom and control. And if you're going for the whole situated learning theory, you want to lean more towards the freedom side, but you still have to create situations in Second Life. You have to fold in scaffolding and more traditional types of debriefing, I think, to make sure that students are connecting their Second Life experiences to the real world. And just the final point, the very last slide, is the fact that boundaries can become really blurry. You know, it depends on how you feel about boundaries, but it's really important to know that, like other online technologies, these virtual worlds can really kind of eliminate any sort of power differential between the instructor and the student. And sometimes that can become confusing, I think, to students. It creates a sort of intimacy that you have to figure out how to navigate and be prepared for. I mean, especially in a place like Second Life, which is a little more, I guess, permissive than your average metropolitan city. And I think I've talked to a lot of colleagues who are women who feel that they have to really deal with boundary issues in the classroom, and I tend to have that problem as well because I look like I'm younger than I actually am, and it's hard because you don't want to alienate students. You want to, like, tap the power of this technology, but it's just something to be aware of, that you should go into it knowing what your boundaries are up front. And I guess that's it. I think I've probably swallowed up all of the time. I don't know if we have any time left for questions.
And we've reached the end of our time for the web seminar, but we really would like to thank you for sharing your perspectives with us today, and also for the ELI members who participated in today's web seminar. Lots of active discussion and conversation, resource sharing on the chat area. So I do want to remind you that if you missed any of the discussion, or if colleagues on your campus or other ELI institutions would like to review it, we'll have a link to the seminar archive off of the ELI Web Seminars homepage after today. So you'll have an opportunity to review the resources that were listed in the chat area, as well as many of the questions and shared answers from participants. Also, if you have time for discussion, there is a set of questions that were posted on the Web Seminar website that you can use as a starting point. Please plan to join us for our next seminar on March the 3rd at 1 o'clock Eastern, when Terry Anderson, professor and Canada Research Chair in Distance Education, will present Many Students Loosely Joined, Social Software to Support Distance Education Learners. For all of us at ELI, this is Julie Little, and we look forward to having you join us for our next ELI web seminar. And again, thank you today, Erin.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was really an honor to be invited. Hello?